I invite you to open up your Bibles to Genesis chapter 32, and we'll be looking there together this evening. It's good to see you again this evening, and especially to the visitors. As has already been said, we're so thankful for your presence, and looking forward to continuing our study in the books of Moses, or the books of the law. If you're looking in the New Testament, and I know most of you know this, but if you're looking in the New Testament and there's a reference to the law, it would be inclusive as a category of all the books that Moses wrote. And they sort of divided it up into the law and the prophets. And so that's kind of an all-encompassing term. It's an encompassing term that's sort of represented there on the Mount of Transfiguration with Moses on one side and Elijah on the other. And as they fade, of course, God says, "This is my beloved son, hear him." He's shining after they faded. And so we're looking at the law portion of that. And we're going to spend one more lesson in the book of Genesis. This morning we talked about the story of creation, which I think undergirds everything. We're going to look at one more lesson this evening. Tomorrow night we'll take one lesson from Exodus and then a lesson from Leviticus, one from Numbers, and then one from Deuteronomy. And Friday night I hope that we'll talk about some connections between the law and the New Testament. In order to sort of wrap things up. Tonight, I want to look at Genesis chapter 32 in one of the more, I think for me at least, difficult stories in the book of Genesis. In reading about Jacob wrestling with an angel, you read through it and at the very least, you just feel like you're not sure what to make of it. I'm not sure what to make of it at times. And so what we do, maybe with stories like that, is we focus a little bit more on the story right before that and a little bit more on the story after that and hope people don't notice that we skipped over a whole chapter. But we need, I think, to lean in to stories that are difficult and maybe take a little bit more work and understand what we said this morning is true. It's all God's words and it's all profitable and it's all worth studying. And even if what you come away with is something less than comprehensive, maybe you don't understand every detail, I think by digging, what you can find is maybe there's more to understand or there's more to easily understand than there is at a first pass. There can be connections drawn. There's certainly other places where the Bible will comment maybe on that story, and that's going to be very helpful. And we'll certainly see that as we look through this lesson this evening. Coming into the story, if we begin at the beginning of the chapter, Jacob has just fled from Laban. He has spent years in labor with Laban. That's a tongue twister. He's been working for Laban for a while. And it has not gone just really smooth. Now, it's turned out well for Jacob, but only through great struggle. He has not had an easy road of it, and he explains that to Laban as Laban comes up and sort of acts innocently affronted. You know, how could you leave me? And Jacob's, you know, honestly, let's be real here. You haven't been very favorable to me. And so they make a bargain there, and they draw a DMZ zone there, and you don't come across that to do me harm, and I won't come across that to do you harm. And so that's where we leave off at the end of chapter 30. And then coming into chapter 32, it says Jacob went on his way and the angels of God met him. And Jacob, when he saw them, said when he saw them, "This is God's camp." So he named that place Mahanaim. And Mahanaim would mean two camps. So you got the camp of God and the camp of Jacob, you might say. It's interesting to me already that Jacob, if you recall, we referenced this morning when he was leaving the land of Israel. He saw angels. And at that point, they were ascending and descending. And now he's coming back and he sees them again. And I think there's at least something significant to say. There's some patterns that we might say we see with Jacob leaving and coming back to the land of promise. Continuing on, though, what we find next is that Jacob sends on messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And so Esau has already developed a certain level of notoriety and even has enough men to sort of to field something like a military. It'd be similar to what Abraham had a few generations before this, a couple of generations. And so Jacob sends word to Esau, and the men basically come back and say, oh no, he's coming to you. And he's got 400 men. And Jacob is frightened because the last he heard, Esau's going to kill him. So he sends these waves. He makes all the preparation he can make. He sets up waves of gifts to come before Esau, plead his case. And as each gift comes, they're going to be saying, this is from your servant Jacob. He's showing all sorts of humility here in the face of Esau. These are from your servant Jacob, and he's coming along behind us. And hopefully, in Jacob's mind, by the time he arrives on the scene, why, the purchase will have been made, and there'll be no more hostilities. Well, that brings us now to the story that begins really in about chapter, verse about 20 to 21. He makes his final preparations. He sends his family on before him, and he alone is left on this side of the river Jabbok, which is that southern tributary that goes into the Jordan River, as you're looking at the center of that Palestinian map that we regularly look at. And so he's there by the river, and verse 20 tells us he arose that same night, took his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children, crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream. So there's some wording there that may be confusing, but it sounds like he's getting up to go, but when they get there, he sends them across, and he stays on the other side. He was left alone, it says, verse 24. And a man wrestled with him until daybreak. There is no introduction for the man. Who is the man wrestling with him? As we continue on, we're obviously going to see that he indicates that he's wrestling with God, and that this is God who's speaking to him. But as to who it is, if you go over to Hosea chapter 12, in Hosea chapter 12, and there in verse 3, speaking of Jacob, it says, in the womb he took his brother by the heel, and in his maturity he contended with God. Well, that's what we're going to see over in our text. He contended with God. But then in verse 4, he wrestled, it says, with the angel and prevailed. And he wept and sought his favor. And he found him at Bethel, and there he spoke with us. So, Hosea, going back to tell us the story, calls him an angel, calls him God, and so what could fit that category? Well, I only know of one angelic being that could fit the category of both angel and God. That would be the angel of the Lord. Sometimes when I'm telling this story, I might say Jacob wrestled with an angel, and somebody says, well, it doesn't say angel. Well, it doesn't, you're right. But then Hosea does, and I'll take his word for it. So I assume he knows better than I do. And he calls him an angel, and he calls him God. Well, the angel of the Lord, we won't have time to go into all the places where we could look him up, but there are several places where the angel of the Lord appears to Abraham. He appears to the parents of Samson. And what we find in these occasions is that, number one, the language transitions from the angel of the Lord speaking to the Lord speaking. And so that's one thing that indicates there's some deity being represented there. The other aspect is there's worship of the angel of the Lord. And we know, especially from Revelation, angels don't accept worship to themselves. This angel does. And so I think what we see is a representation in the angel of the Lord. What we see is a representation of deity. I don't want to get all into the possibilities. I really only see a couple of possibilities. Either the Holy Spirit represented as an angel, or more distinctly, I think quite likely it's Jesus pre-incarnate, before he comes to earth as a man. But in some way, God is being represented visibly to man in these cases. That seems to be the most likely case here in Genesis chapter 32. And then it tells us that Jacob wrestles with him all night. Doesn't give us a blow by blow. In fact, it just says it. He wrestled with him all night. The story is so all of a sudden. You talk about a story that you want more details. It says he's left alone and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. And you're like, wait. Where did he come from? Did they have a conversation that developed into a wrestling match? I mean, what exactly happened? You don't get that. And we must be content with the part that we're given. So they wrestled until daybreak. What do we make of that wrestling? Well, I think one thing that we need to note about the wrestling, over in Hosea, you'll note it used the word contended. In the Septuagint, it uses a word that is found in the New Testament only once. In Luke chapter 22, Luke chapter 22, and in verse 44. Luke 22, and in verse 44, it says, "And being in agony, he was praying fervently, and his sweat became like drops of blood falling down upon the ground." Now, you're familiar with that passage. It's Jesus praying the night that he was to be betrayed. And the word there, agony, is the same word as this word contend. In fact, that's part of the word that you see over in Jude 3, contend earnestly for the faith. The definition in the New American Standard Greek lexicon for this word agony is a struggle for victory, gymnastic exercise, wrestling. So that's the definition for the Greek word for Jesus here being in agony. Well, what's Jesus doing? What's he wrestling with? Well, you might say he's wrestling with God. Not in a way to obtain victory over God, but with God. He's wrestling to help, for God to help him and pleading with God. And there is agony. There's a struggle going on. And I think that helps educate us about what's going on with Jacob. Certainly by the end of the story, we're going to see, I think, some parallels, some overlap between what Jesus is doing and what Jacob is doing back in Genesis 32. Well, going back over to Genesis and continuing on, it says, "When he," speaking of the angel, "saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh," of Jacob's thigh, "so that the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him." Now, that is instructive. We don't get a blow-by-blow, but we do get how the match ended. And the match ended in such a way as to let us know who was in control the whole time. Because if you can end a wrestling match by just touching someone, then what that tells me is you had the thing in the bag the whole time. You just were allowing this thing to go on. And that's the truth of the matter. This is not a situation, as is always the case, where you have on the one side man struggling, on the other side God struggling, and by the skin of his teeth God will prevail. Some people read Revelation like that sometimes. You know, like it's this terrible back and forth, and God will out in double overtime, you know, at the nick of time. And instead, when you read the book of Revelation, rather, it's just God sitting there, and he's watching, and he's observing. And on one of the occasions, he just speaks forth from the temple and says, "It is finished." And he doesn't even stand up from his throne. It's just over. And I get that idea here. It's, okay, this is enough. And he touches the thigh. Now, what that tells me is that everything up to this point, and including this point, is mercy. Because if this angel had wanted to, Jacob would be destroyed. He has no chance. And I think when we read the Psalms, we see some of that mercy. The psalmists cry out to God, and they say things to God that make us uncomfortable. Their cries are filled with sometimes anger and frustration, certainly sadness and grief and doubt. And God leaves room for it. That doesn't mean God encourages it. I don't mean that God says, "Oh, good for you, you've got doubt." But he allows us to struggle through to get to victory. And he allows us to pray to him even when what we are saying in our prayers and in our struggles is the beginnings of that struggle, not the end. And you'll notice that in so many of the Psalms. Psalm 22, I think, is that. It's, why have you forsaken me? By the end of the Psalm, what is he saying? I know you haven't. Right? And so how many times does the psalmist do that? He starts, why aren't you listening to me? By the end, he's going, but I know you do hear me. And so I think that's what you see. And I think we have to do that sometimes. I've had people say to me before, they say, I don't feel like God is listening. Hey, welcome to the club. And they think somehow if they were more spiritual, they wouldn't feel that way. David's a very spiritual man. And David felt that. And he struggled and he wrestled with those things. And God's mercy leaves us room. I don't mean room to be blasphemous. I don't mean room to speak ill of God, but room to struggle through difficulty. Well, he dislocates his hip, and then in verse 26, it says, he said, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. Jacob's response, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Now, what do you think about that? When I read that, I think, well, that sounds maybe that sounds imprudent or impolite or worse yet, demanding. I mean, who is Jacob at this point to be demanding such things? But again, if we go back over to Hosea and chapter 12, and again, as we look in verse 4, yes, he wrestled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. So, you know, sometimes when you're reading text, you don't know. We were studying the other day and trying to figure out whether Paul was being sarcastic in one place or another. Sometimes it's hard to figure out. You know, is he being sincere? Is he kind of being a little cheeky there? Hosea tells us right here, there's tears. This is not arrogance. This is not Jacob saying, no, I will have my way. I get the idea. He's holding on as much as he can with all he's got left. He's been disabled, literally disabled. And so what he's doing is clinging and saying, I don't want to let go until you bless me. Now, could I suggest to you this? When the angel comes, there's wrestling. I don't know the nature of that wrestling to be sure, but I assume there's an intent for Jacob to overpower. I mean, that's generally what a wrestling match is you got two people trying to overpower. He's done trying to overpower. At this point, this is a cry of surrender. But it's surrender that says, bless me. And that's the thing about prevailing with God. You win with God when you surrender to God. It is the great irony. You don't win by imposing your will over him, by telling him how it's going to be. The reason that is because God always knows best. What I want to see in that is my need not to just yield to God's commandments because they're God's commandments. We need to do that. God can say, do this because I said so because I'm God. He can say that. But more than that, I want to move past that to the point of yielding like this with a full understanding. You know what's best with trust, with a belief that your blessing, God's blessing, is the only way to move forward. There's really no point otherwise. And I think Jacob has lived his life with confidence in his own wiles, right? He has, in so many ways, trusted in cunning and even deceit at times. And I think there's a major transition in Jacob's life at this event. We'll see as the response of the angel suggests that. So we find that victory is in surrender, or as Paul puts it over in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. And I think this is a beautiful concept, and I think it's a concept that is illustrated in the story of Jacob. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul speaking of his thorn in the flesh that he's prayed three times would be removed from him. And now he says in chapter 12 and verse 10 of 2 Corinthians, therefore, I am content I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Some people foolishly point to that and say, what Paul is saying is when he's in the midst of sin, that kind of weakness is when he is strongest. Well, first of all, he says thorn in the flesh, not sin is what he's talking about. He's talking about discomfort of some sort in his life. But more than that, what it is just a recognition that I cannot, I don't know what's best for me. God knows better than me what's best for me. And I need to yield to that. It is most truly expressed in Jesus' prayer, your will be done, not mine. Every prayer needs to be sincerely colored with that phrase. If we don't use it literally, it needs to be overhanging our every prayer. I really want what you say is best. Now, I want that with my kids. I would love for my children to come to me in every particular and say, I'm going to do what you say is best. Here's the problem. As much as I think I know what's best, and I think I do have a better idea than they do, but the bottom line is sometimes I don't. With God, every time. There will never be a time that he doesn't know best. There will never be a time that his way is not better than our way. And so, yielding to that, surrendering to that, we will find what is best, our best path forward. Well, back to the text again, Genesis 32. And now looking at verse 27. So he, the angel, said to him, to Jacob, what is your name? And he said, it is Jacob. He said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. Well, first of all, what on earth is he asking this question for? It is reminiscent of the questions that God asks on occasion. He asks as he comes into the garden, where are you? And Adam says, we are hiding. Is it because God was saying, they're really good hiders? And of course not. Why does God ever ask questions? I think it's always, always God asks questions because he wants you to acknowledge the answer. It's why we ask our kids questions. You know, we say, what have you done? We know what they did. And we say, what have you done? And they just stare at us. And we compel them to speak. We say, you must tell me what you've done. And then they say it. And it's not revelation. We just want to hear them admit, yes, this is what I did. Spell it out. Say it. It's confession. I mean, that's what it is. And what confession is, in fact, the very definition of the word is agreement, especially the New Testament word. And it's when you agree with God that your sin is what he says it is. That's confession. A lot of times we think of it as confessing something that's been secret and making it open. There is a sense of that, especially in the Old Testament. But particularly in the New Testament, confession, we confess the name of Christ. What are we doing? We're not revealing it. We're saying the same thing about Jesus that God says about Jesus. And when it comes to our sin, we're saying the same thing about our sin that God says about our sin. And in the case of Jacob, when the angel says, what is your name? And he says, Jacob, well, what he's doing is he's admitting what his name is. Now you say, well, what's the big deal about admitting what your name is? Well, names have meaning. And they have a lot more meaning in the Bible than they do today. You know, we generally, a lot of times we name our kids based on what we like the sound of or some family member or something of that sort. But in these cases, the words themselves mean something. We were studying Nabal the other day, whose father must have hated him, for his name means worthless. And maybe that's why he was. Could be. But what does Jacob's name mean? It means usurper. And some other definitions that are brought into that sort of boundaries of that name are deceiver and schemer. And I believe when Jacob says, my name is Jacob, what he's doing is saying, well and truly, it is. That's who he is. And so he says, you bless me. He says, all right, who are you? And he says, I'm Jacob. And I think what the angel says is, well, not anymore. You need to be somebody else. And so he gives him a different name. He gives him the name Israel, wrestled with God, or striven with God. And he says, because you have striven with God and with men and prevailed. In what way is he striven with God? Well, I think that he is striven with God, as we've already suggested, through yielding. He has prevailed through yielding. And because he has yielded to God, he has prevailed with God. But then that is also, I think this is prophetic as much as it is speaking to past events. I think it's speaking to future events. Here is Jacob on the eve of meeting up with his brother, a man who is very afraid of meeting. And what does this angel, the Lord, give him but confidence? You're going to be just fine. And so you've prevailed with God and you will prevail with men. One of the things you always want to keep in mind about these things is step back and remember the story. Jacob is about to cross over into the promised land. So this is not just a situation that it's not happenstance. And as we go forward, what we're going to see is every crossing into the promised land is profound and is packed with meaning. Abraham going down to Egypt and then coming back to the promised land. There's a lot of meaning there. And I think Jacob coming back into the promised land, there's meaning. The people who would have been reading this for the first time would have been people who were headed towards the promised land. And they're being told what the name of their nation means, what the origins of that nation are. Jacob is about to, incidentally, put away his household gods. And so Israel would have to put away the gods that they had dragged along from Egypt. And so there's so many parallels that they should have or could have seen from this story and their own story. In Exodus chapter 23, though, Exodus chapter 23, and beginning in verse 20, behold, God says, I'm going to send an angel before you to guard you along the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Be on your guard before him and obey his voice. Do not be rebellious towards him, for he will not pardon your transgression, since my name is in him. The idea of sending this angel on before them as they're going into the promised land. Here they have a story of an angel who's telling Jacob he will prevail. Don't rebel, yield. Do what he says. Follow after him. You want the victory. You want to prevail among men. Yield to him. Yield to me. And he goes on to say, in verse 33, they shall not live in your land because they will make you sin against me. If you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare for you. You want to not fall into that trap, then you continue to yield like Jacob did to God. And I think there's just a lot of lessons in that for us, in the wrestling with God, the struggle, the yielding to God in order to prevail with God. And maybe one more lesson as we go back to the text there. In Genesis 32, and that Jacob asks a question in response. So after he tells him, you've striven with God and with men and have prevailed, he says, then Jacob asked him, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And he blessed him there. And so Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been preserved. Peniel, the face of God. So he asked the question, what's your name? And the angel says, why are you asking that? And, the tables have turned, you might say, in this case. I mean, what's the difference in him asking the angel and the angel asking him? Well, the angel has authority. That's the difference. But what we see in the next place, the angel doesn't have to admit who he is. That's the other difference. There's no confession necessary in that case. What we see in the next verse is Jacob already knew the answer. And so he doesn't give it to him. There are a great many people who wish God would tell them things that he's already told them. I wish God would just tell me what he wants from my life. He already has. I just wish God would tell me who he is. He already has. I had one guy tell me, I wish God would just come down here and show himself to man. I said, he already did. He was mad at God for not giving enough evidence. He already has. And that's what Jacob's asking for, more than he needs. You read a story like this, I tell you, I feel a little sympathy with that because I'd like to know the rest of the story. But I got what I need, and I know I do. And I know I have enough to be able to speak truth about God, say the things I need to say about God, to know the things I need to know about him, and to move forward with that confidence. Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Penuel, and he was limping on his thigh. Therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh in the sinew of the hip. You wonder if this story is important. That last little verse should tell you something of its importance. I wonder if reading this a few hundred years later, as they're wandering in the wilderness maybe, and they come across this and they go, oh, that's why we don't eat that part. That seems to be the indication, as he says, therefore to this day, this is before the law. This has not got anything to do with Leviticus and Exodus and how the meat gets divided up and so forth. This is something different entirely. And it sounds like there's a tradition that has been firmly ensconced in Israel's history. And when they would go back and read this, it would remind them, all to remind them, oh, that's why we don't do that. That's why we don't eat that. Moses says to this day, this tradition survived the slavery of Egypt. That seems to me to make that story pretty important. And so here's a story that we don't have a lot about, we don't know a lot about, but it was important enough to establish a tradition that would be kept, and Moses recognizes that and says, this is to call you to remember this story, to remember the nature of your relationship to God. It is one of surrender. It is one of yielding to God. It is one of mercy. He could disable you and make you limp, and you would be better for it. And certainly Jacob was. What's in a name? There's so much in a name. There's so many things being named here. There's the place, Penuel, being named. There's Bethel that Jacob is about to return to in a couple of chapters. There's the very word Jabbok, river. It doesn't say that it's named in this place, but Jabbok is one letter different from Jacob, it is one letter different from Jacob. It's two letters swapped around, the B and the Q in Hebrew. But the word wrestle is actually one letter off from Jabbok. And so I wonder if the river didn't take the name from this event as well. And so all of these landmarks being put in place, these reminders being put in place, it's one of the things that I think we need to do more often, more frequently. And something we read so often in the Old Testament is how often God says, I'm going to put this here because I don't want you to forget. I want you to remember some aspect, some nature of our relationship. We'll see more of that as we continue through these stories in the Old Testament. It may be that you're here this evening and you struggle. Maybe you are in the midst of wrestling. Maybe you're wondering, maybe you're thinking, where do I take this? One of the most precious things about the psalmists as they are taking their grief and their frustration to God is that you realize that in the midst of that frustration, you may think, well, that sounds like they don't have enough faith. Well, they are talking to God. Real faithlessness means I'm not going to talk to God anymore. You're frustrated, so you stop talking to God. They have frustration. They never question where to go with it. They always bring it to God. There are people from time to time that will say, I'm going to come, I'm going to get right, and then I'm going to come back. That's backwards. You come towards God. Bring your baggage. That's where you will take care of it. That's where you will actually be able to do something about it. As long as you're struggling out there, you are striving with men, but you will not prevail. And so I hope that that story draws you near and that you are able, if you need to, strive with God and prevail by yielding to Him this evening. If there's any way that we can help you, won't you come forward while we stand and while we sing?